Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Your City. With me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, along with Dante Alighieri and several others. Get back to me on Lamplight at cambridge105.fm or RLA at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And now for tonight's show, where you are invited to attend. First, here's a little extended station identification. Cambridge 105 is community radio in your city. We broadcast a mixture of adult contemporary music and local magazine programs during daytimes. After 7 p.m. each weeknight and at weekends, we showcase the best in specialist music from rock and soul to hip-hop and local music, as well as spoken word. Now, last time you will recall... Okay, there we go. Last time... Back to Dante. Last time, you will recall, my cold kept me from doing the show, and we attended to a wonderful show from last year featuring Neil Henry and Andrew Abbey in the studio. Thanks to everyone who agreed with me that it was great fun. But this evening, under lamplight, we return to Dante's Inferno, now up to Canto 8. We've been covering one canto per show, but there's too much to say about this canto to fit into one show. We'll cover one episode of Canto 8 this evening, and then the second major episode next time. You'll remember that we left Dante and Virgil last time standing on the shore of the River Styx, S-T-Y-X, which was not so much a river as a muddy swamp, where the souls of those who let anger get the best of them are now thrashing about, ripping each other apart in their mad fury, and where, under the water... are the sullen or the despairing souls whose pathetic sighs are bubbling up to the surface. Walking around the shoreline of this marsh, they come up to a tall tower, and that's where we left off. So, what happens next? Well, first, what about this tower? Dante tells us that for a long time, as they'd been walking along the shore, they'd noticed two flames, two torchlights, shining from a window high up in a tower, and then a flashing signal from somewhere far off in the distance. Anyone in Dante's time would have immediately understood flaming lights from high towers as some kind of military signal, something like one if by land, two if by sea. Now Dante, who has all along been feeling like he's wandering through some enemy territory where he's not welcome, is now immediately alarmed. Has he been spotted by some guards who are going to come at him in force? Besides the military threat, there's something pretty eerie about these lights, which just appear. We have no idea how or by whom they were lit. Dante turns to Virgil and asks a rapid string of questions. What does this mean? And what does that answering fire in that distant tower mean? And who's behind all this? Virgil calms him down, explaining that the lights are signaling for someone on the other shore to come over this way and pick up some passengers to be transported across the marsh. And accordingly, here, speeding across the marsh, comes a boat to carry Virgil and Dante, piloted by an old man propelling the boat like a punt. with a long pole in the stern. This old man is Phlegyas, someone it's interesting to learn more about. Phlegyas is, we might say, their host as they pass through this region of anger, across the Styx to the terrible city of Dis, which contains the rest of hell. And who is Phlegyas? Well, Dante doesn't tell us anything about this character. He appears, has a short dialogue with the Virgil and Dante, pilots the boat across the river, and disappears. No background, no explanation, no description. Like the other functionaries we have met, Phlegyas goes about his assigned tasks mechanically. Even his angry outburst feels mechanical. But Dante does not need to tell us much about Phlegyas. He assumes that we will know all about this character from our previous encounters with him in classical mythology. And if you've never encountered him in classical mythology, stick around, because I'll help you out. Now, we can learn something about Phlegyas first by knowing that his name itself comes from the Greek word for burning, allied to phlegethon, the burning river in the Greek underworld. And we'll soon come upon Dante's version of the river Phlegethon, not, though, as a river of burning water, but a river of burning blood. We saw last time the two types of anger depicted in the Stygian marsh, first the rage that wants to rip apart everything in reach, and second the sullenness or sloth that just bubbles in despair and suppressed anger. Phlegyas combines both aspects. He brings together anger and fire, the kind of rage that burns and destroys, but also, when not flaming, lying hidden below the surface, smoldering, waiting to burst out into flame again. Now, Phlegyas was the son of Ares, the god of war, and this in itself adds a warlike quality to the burning. It's akin to the raging violence of soldiers on the warpath. But also the mythic connection with a god suggests there is something holy about this kind of rage. Phlegyas is not just some nobody. He comes from a god. We must attend in awe. And here's a little story about Phlegyas, which Dante could assume his readers knew. We can't be so confident today. But wait. Wait, before we go into the story, let's create an appropriate setting with a few minutes of the crazy world of Arthur Brown and the burning rage of his song, Fire.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
Now, the story goes that Phlegyas and his followers were marauders, going around sacking and burning other people's houses and lands. Eventually, they attacked the sanctuary of the god Apollo at Delphi, bringing down upon themselves the wrath of Apollo, who destroyed them with thunderbolts and earthquakes. The attack on Delphi was not a random act of violence, though. Phlegyas was avenging what he took to be the wrong done to his daughter Coronis, whom Apollo had loved or raped. And in his response to this affront to his daughter, Phlegyas became a version of that modern film character whose wife or daughter gets attacked, raped, or killed in the streets, and then he goes on a one-man rampage to seek revenge. Like these modern heroes, Phlegyas went too far. He rushed into things and thought he could take care of matters with his own hands. He was wrong. In the modern versions of the Vengeful Father, I think we judge the rage to be justified by the horror of the outrage. The classical myth, however, reminds us that rage is always impious when directed against holy things. Now, the rashness in Phlegrius' anger arose because he was too literal-minded. To him, Apollo was just some man assaulting his daughter. Our awareness of the horror of sexual rape today tends to make us agree with Phlegrius. All we see is a male unjustly assaulting a female. But in myth, we are in a different realm. When in Greek myths a god is attracted to a mortal woman, he always has sex with her, quickly and without considering her feelings about this. The woman always becomes pregnant. Mythically, this is an image of the way some divine impulse enters into us, usually, in fact, without our consent or even full awareness, and always with the shock of surprise. And this divine coupling impregnates us and eventually bears fruit in some good work, some fine perception or work of art or whatever. Had Phlegrius realized, had he realized that this was no ordinary suitor, but a god come to implant something divine into his daughter, he might have been less rash with his anger. He might have waited piously to see the manifestation of this divine act. And if he had waited, he would have discovered that the child born of the union of Apollo and Coronis was Asclepius, the greatest healer of his age, the man Homer calls the blameless physician. Phlegrius used his rage for vengeance. But it's no good trying to get vengeance on a god. Look at the story. Out of all this rage, the sacrilege of burning the temple and killing Apollo's priests, out of all this, nevertheless, came the god of healing. So we are on the alert here not to give up. This circle of anger on which we're propelled by Phlegrius can lead to healing. Phlegrius appears as a monster, but he has his place in the divine ordering of the world. Out of Phlegrius comes Asclepius, that is, from burning anger can come healing. We're talking about that kind of revitalizing healing, not a setting a broken bone or curing a bad back. Asclepius, in fact, was the only mortal able to bring the dead back to life. And let us hope that we have here, too, an image of what can happen to us as we read. Let us hope that as we spend time meditating on Phlegrius in Dante's Circle of Anger, we may in the end be led to our own healing, our own transformation of what is dead in us back to life. We've been looking at the image of Phlegrius as seen in classical mythology. Well, one of the things I feel I can share here on Evening Under Lamplight is a knowledge of these ancient stories and characters and myths, which get very little attention in our popular culture. I hope I can present them vividly to you and that we can all brighten our imaginations with these things. Now, from myth to poetry, and it's time to return to how Dante portrays Phlegrius. And there's something almost comical about him, as there is about most of the functionaries of hell. Dante and Virgil are standing on the shore of the Styx, watching those naked souls tear each other apart, when Phlegrius suddenly races across the swamp towards them. The way he zooms up to them reminds me of a cartoon. A bowstring never shot an arrow off that cut the thin air any faster than a little boat I saw that very second skimming along the water in our direction. Zoom! One minute he's there, the next minute he's here. He's so eager to grab this new soul. "I've caught you now, you miserable soul," he cries out, taunting this figure he thinks is coming into his eternal pain of damnation. Like all these mechanical functionaries, he has only one thing on his mind and cannot change. But his eagerness to catch Dante is futile. Virgil firmly tells him that Dante will stay with him only as long as it takes to get across the Styx. Phlegrius is a dupe here, with no chance of success, despite his speedy and greedy rush to grab a new victim. And this is comforting, after all. We are ultimately safe from the ill effects of anger as long as, like Dante, We journey through hell in order to confront our own inner selves with honesty and a willingness to change. In doing this, we must pass through anger, but it is only temporary, just a passage. Anger can make no claims upon us. Maybe so, but it certainly can try to claim us. When Virgil steps into Phlegia's boat, the boat floats as light in the water as before. But when Dante steps into the boat, it rides lower in the water. Virgil carries no weight. Dante does. It's not surprising that Virgil has no weight. He's a shade, a ghost. Symbolically, he stands for human reason, and perhaps this image reminds us of how little weight reason carries in moments of anger. Dante, of course, has weight because in the story he is still a flesh and blood human being. But why does the poet give us this detail at this point in the story? Is it a hint to show that anger was one of Dante's besetting sins? If this is so, then we had better be alert as we watch the crossing to see how Dante responds to his encounter with a tempting sin. And so Dante is ferried across the Stygian marsh. But instead of looking at this incident from the outside, let's first try to recreate the feel of this journey and of the encounter there. Let's suppose Dante were talking to us today about the journey. What would he say? So there we were in that flat boat, riding too deep in the water, which kept splashing over the gunwales, making oozy, muddy puddles at my feet. Phlegias was in the stern, grunting each time he pushed down on his pole. I couldn't tell if he was angry at some obstruction in the marsh, or furious that he had to ferry me across in safety when I could tell from his eyes that he'd rather rip me apart. Virgil was standing behind me in that silent, observant way of his that frankly began to feel a little creepy. I know he only meant the best, and he was, after all, on a mission from the heavenly Beatrice, but I'd already said and done a few things that made him reply to me in sharp, even angry tones. But I was too interested in what was going on all around me to think too much of Virgil. I was leaning forward to peer into that gloomy atmosphere where I couldn't see anything very clearly. I could tell by the noise that there must have been thousands of souls all around me, thrashing and splashing in that filthy mud, shouting at each other, roaring as they attacked one of their fellows, or screaming in pain as they were assaulted in turn. And the stench, it was growing worse every moment. I thought it was bad in that freezing rain in the circle of the gluttons, but this place really stank. There was that mud, first of all, and who knows what it was made of. And I'm sure all those bubbles that kept rising to the surface were adding something to the overall aroma. But there was something else mixed in with that smell, something that felt like it was coming from a long way off, from out of the depths of the earth, like burning blood, or open sewers, or putrefying bodies, or all of these. So although I had to keep leaning forward to see better into the darkness, a part of me just wanted to recoil in disgust from that stink. There were so many bodies around us that the boat kept bumping into things, a shoulder, a rump, and once I'm sure we smacked someone in the skull right between the eyes. But no one paid any attention. They were so caught up in fighting each other. That's what made what happened next so unexpected and so horrible. Without any warning, this one figure suddenly started up just in front of me, covered in slime, just a shape, white eyes, and a red hole where the mouth was, stuff hanging from him which could have been his hair in muddy strips hanging down, or maybe bits of marsh reed clinging to him. His shoulders were hunched, and he was staring straight up at me as though he'd tear me apart if he could reach me. I jumped back in fright and horror so quickly I nearly fell over the other side of the boat, and before I could regain my balance, he started shouting at me, "Who are you? What are you doing in this death place while you're still alive?" Everyone knows I'm not someone to resort to cheap taunts, but I was so shaken that all I could do was sneer back at him. "Yeah, I'm here in hell, but at least I'll be out of here soon, unlike you." And then I threw his own question back at him. "Who do you think you are, you ugly piece of slime?" I wanted to know who he was, since, after all, I was going through this ordeal to learn as much as I could about these creatures, wasn't I? As soon as I asked who he was, something changed in him. That rage seemed to transform into something else, something sad, heavy, defeated. I never expected his reply. "Who am I? You can see for yourself. I'm someone who weeps." Was he trying to play on my sympathies? If so, it nearly worked, but I'd been fooled like that already and was still smarting from the shame of fainting from pity at Francesca's seductive account of her adultery. I peered more closely, and something looked familiar. I wanted to tell him just to go to hell, but of course I couldn't. So I lowered my voice, bent closer to him, and said slowly and venomously, "I hope you keep on weeping here in hell for all eternity. I can see through that filth. I know who you are." Maybe I shouldn't have said that. All that sadness he'd put on disappeared, and he was raging as fiercely as ever. He stretched his arms out toward the boat and made as if to leap over the side and grab me. I fell back, not knowing what to do next. I had no weapons. How do you fight off a dead man anyway? Just then, Virgil, always there when I needed him, stepped forward. "Get back in there with the other dogs," he ordered, shoving him away from us, back into the slime. I had been half expecting Virgil to come to my help in this encounter, but I never expected what he did next. He turned to me, hugged me around the neck like some passionate lover or something, and kissed me. What had I done that deserved this? Well, he explained, as usual, in his indirect way. First he praised my indignation. That was the right kind of anger. And then, almost like some kind of prayer, he blessed my mother's womb where I was conceived. It felt like he was ushering me into some kind of new birth here. I didn't have time to consider the significance of this because Virgil was now going on with one of his long explanations about what we'd just seen. He told me that when he was alive, that man was full of arrogance, and no one up there in the living world now remembers anything good about him. That's why he's so angry here in hell. There are many others in the world who also think too highly of themselves and who will leave only bad memories in others' minds when they die and who will also end up here in the filthy swamp. I didn't really answer Virgil, what could I have said, but expressed a deep desire that surprised even myself. Maybe I was still feeling a little proud of myself after Virgil's praise. "You know what would make me really happy right now? I'd like to see that guy dunked in the soup one more time before we leave." Virgil's eyes gave that kind of prophetic gleam I was to see many times, and he replied, "Don't worry. You'll get your wish before we even get within view of the other shore. This is the kind of wish that's worth fulfilling." He was right. In a few minutes, a gang of other muddy souls yelled out, "Get Filippo Argenti!" and jumped on that guy who'd confronted me, ripping him apart. But before they could even get to him, Argenti himself started gnashing at his own body like some demon or like some dog gone mad with fleas. It was one of the more gruesome sights I came across in hell, but I thank God I was able to see it. And that's all there is to this episode on the Stygian Marsh. Absolved,
Amen. Amen.
That was the Mantra Project with Absolve. The album is called Musical Conversations Across the Indian Ocean and merges the colonial Portuguese and native Indian musical styles. I thought it gave a good interlude at this point in our journey as we see Dante being absolved of the sin of anger. And maybe we too can redeem our anger attending to Dante here in the eighth canto of the Inferno, gathered together at this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and with our now notorious little tag.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. Evening under lamplight, it's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you, Neil Henry. Well, so we've heard how Dante might tell us the story of his crossing the Stygian marsh in today's language, giving us fuller detail than the tight verse allows in the actual poem. That's the literal story. Now, what about its significance? Let's first play with the image of this embodiment of anger suddenly rising out of the water. There's a Greek word for this, anodiomene, a rising up after having been submerged. But that usually refers to the birth of beautiful Aphrodite rising up out of the water. Thomas More adds that on the mythic level, this image of the goddess of love rising up after being submerged can describe the arousal of sexual feelings, sensation, awareness coming into consciousness from a deep source that we may locate within. We have all experienced this kind of thing, taken by surprise with a sudden arousal by something we would never have suspected would be arousing. It's not just sex. Appreciation of beauty or even new ideas that stir us can arise in our minds suddenly as out of the waters of the unconscious. But anger? Yes, sure. Anger, too, partakes of anodiomene. It can, Dante's image tells us, suddenly arise from deep within us even in moments when we thought we were safe. A friend was lamenting this to me just the other day. "I still have this surprising anger," he said. "I'm driving down the road in a cheerful mood and some stupid driver will suddenly pull in front of me and get me in a passion really mad at him. How did that happen? What's going on?" Yeah, who can explain it? The anger just rises up, like Filippo Argenti confronting Dante, who thinks he's passing safely through the region of anger. What matters now is not where the anger came from, but what it has to tell us. There's another way we can look at this. Think of this angry soul, Filippo Argenti, as representing some aspect of anger arising out of Dante's own unconscious. Water often symbolizes that world of the unconscious, fluid, clear when it is still, but usually opaque or thoroughly dark, deep, mysterious. Traveling across the water, apparently safe in the dry boat, can be an image of our soul moving on the surface of consciousness, in rational control of our lives, apparently safe from any eruption from the depths within. But anger, we learn here, cannot be so easily passed over. Picture me the other day in a discussion with a group of friends. We were old friends from university and knew each other's positions. I knew that Paul had a tendency to deny the existence of any other views but his own, and he delighted in goading others. Rather than conduct a complicated argument, he would provoke until his opponent flared up, and then he'd calmly announce victory. Yes, I knew his tricks, and was beginning to feel more and more sorry for him, trapped in this lonely position. I was determined not to let him get to me. In fact, I had determined to look for a way I could take him by surprise and say something supportive of him in the vague hope of being generous and easing his pain. But I forgot about saying something supportive as I listened to him. All my energy was focused on not letting him get to me. I even watched as one or two others flared up at him. I was in that boat, staring into the dimness of the angry souls in the Stygian marsh, thinking I was safely in control of myself. But then it happened. He was talking about murderers no longer having any human rights, and therefore we didn't have to bother understanding their side of an issue. He said, "When you're talking about people who are bloodthirsty murderers, they don't qualify as people to me." I was aware of what was happening to me, even as I lost my temper. "I'm sorry," I said, "but they do qualify as people. Perhaps not people you like very much, but they're still human beings. Who are we to dismiss them with the slick abuse of bloodthirsty murderers? You're always ignoring people's humanity and then getting all sentimental about your respect for democracy and your faith in a loving God. Don't you ever hear yourself talk?" And more of the same came from me. Yep, there it was. Anger rising up, taking me by surprise. More to the point, the more I thought about it, the more I recognized it as arising from my own unconscious, from my shadow self. Like Paul, I too have problems being patient with others. I don't dismiss others with irresponsible tags like bloodthirsty murderers. I'm usually a bit more subtle, but I have my ways. I get angry at this aspect of myself, but don't like to admit it. This anger lurks below the surface while I'm in the boat with Dante, thinking I'm safe. Suddenly it springs up, projecting itself onto what my friend Paul just said, but really just trying to get back at me. I wasn't safe after all. And now I had the consequences of my outburst to deal with. What can I do about this projected anger? Well, let's look at what happens between Dante and Filippo for further leads. The first thing anger does is challenge us. It comes aggressively as though challenging an intruder. Filippo Argenti asks Dante, "Who are you to come here before your time?" We could express this more loosely as something like this. "Who do you think you are? You don't belong here. Get out." This kind of remark either sweeps us away with its power, or it arouses us to strike back. "Oh yes, as who? You want to fight about it?" Now we too would be caught up in the anger. Let's take this further. Who are you to come here before your time? When we meet anger head on, the first thing it does is ask us to identify ourselves. Anger is thus an avenue towards self-knowledge. In Chinese medicine, anger and self-knowledge are complementary emotions. When I got angry with Paul in the story a few minutes ago, I was immediately being given the chance to learn something about myself. Oh, hell, I still have all that anger stored up in me. After asking who Dante is, Filippo accuses him of coming here before his time. Literally, he's asking why Dante is in hell if he is still a living person. That he's alive is obvious, since the boat shows he still has body weight. But his question also serves to take the self-knowledge further. What are you doing here? What is your purpose here? Meeting anger can thus awaken us to our real purpose, whatever that may be. Dante's purpose is to pass through hell and by observing the souls of the damned, to purify his own soul. We are all encouraged to do this before our time, so that while we still have the power to see ourselves and to amend, we can reform ourselves. And Paul and me? Why was I there? Surely not to correct Paul's misconceptions. I'm not his nanny. We were all there for good fellowship, to share ideas and stories and jokes before we got back to our daily routine. And if Paul spoiled some of the fellowship with his taunts, let me at least remember where I am and not make things worse. And how does Dante reply to Filippo? Though I come, I do not stay. But who are you in all your ugliness? Filippo had asked, who are you? Dante, in turn, asks, who are you? Both figures say the same thing, suggesting symbolically that one is the mirror image of the other. This shade arising from the muddy swamp is an image of Dante passing over the swamp in the boat. Looking at this representative of anger, Dante does not see another, but recognizes himself. This is his own anger he is facing. It's often useful to draw a rough sketch of the scene we're encountering, and here it might be good to show Dante leaning over the side of the boat, looking down towards the water as though peering into a mirror, almost like Narcissus. But Narcissus fell in love with what he saw. Dante recoils in disgust. There's something else going on here, probably. You remember that Dante was exiled from his native Florence, right? He was away from the city at the time the exile was decreed, and he was not allowed back home to gather any of his possessions. Some early sources tell us that Filippo Argenti's brother took over the house and its possessions. So, let's see if we can work this out. So, in looking at Filippo, Dante is also seeing Filippo's brother, who now owned the things that Dante had owned. Possessions can symbolize identity. Therefore, Filippo, through his brother, took on the identity of Dante in this symbolic way. All the more reason why Dante, confronting Filippo, is confronting himself. Or here is another way to see Dante's reply. In repeating Filippo's question, Dante is in fact answering the question. What are you doing here? I'm trying to find out who you are. I'm here to discover the identity of anger. It is part of Dante's salvation that he does not flinch under anger's challenges, but takes the initiative and actively pursues his own divinely appointed purpose. It is part of Dante's salvation that he does not flinch under anger's challenges, but takes the initiative and actively pursues his own divinely appointed purposes. Shut up, punk. I'm the one asking the questions around here. Along with that question of identity comes a qualification. Filippo accused Dante of coming to hell before he was dead. Dante answers, though I come, I do not stay. On one level, this is a taunt, implying that although Dante won't be staying here, Filippo certainly will. But he's also recognizing the truth that he is just visiting anger. Taking the initiative, he has the power to move on, unlike those damned souls who gave in to temptation and let the sin take control of their lives. Dante is not dead yet and is journeying under divine protection. Realizing this can keep him from lingering. But if Dante is moving on, it is not as though he expects things to start looking up for him. He is, in fact, going deeper into hell, deeper into his soul, if we want to put it like that. He has worse things to examine before things get better. In one sense, we might even say that Filippo is stuck in the mud of anger because he will not look deeper into himself. Back to the dialogue between Dante and Filippo. Dante had thrown back the question, who are you? And Filippo's reply brings us, I believe, to the crux of the episode. In response to Dante's question of who he is, Filippo replies, you see that I am one who weeps. Vedi che son un che piango. You see that I am one who weeps. This is a startling answer, not least because it is no sort of answer at all. It does not identify who the muddy figure is. It just points to something the figure is doing. And it is a surly reply. You see, he says, as if he means, you have eyes, don't you? You can see what kind of person I am. Why are you asking me? Here again is that rage, taking offense at Dante's question, where perhaps offense was indeed attended. That's the tone of the reply, but now we must consider how odd it is for a figure representing anger to characterize himself as one who weeps. Yet perhaps it's not so odd after all. We have had earlier hints about this link between anger and sorrow in the sad souls sighing and bubbling under the water, and if we remember Virgil's Aeneid, as Dante expects us to, we will recall that the angry Phlegias is there called miserimus, most miserable. Okay, then, what connection do we discover between anger and sorrow? Some might say we become angry after we have had a sad experience. It's the old Rambo pattern of handling your grief by lashing out at those who you think responsible for your grief. Others might say, like an admonishing mother, that all anger will only end in tears. Anger never leads to joy, only to grief. But that's not quite what Dante is presenting here. Filippo does not say, "I am weeping because I used to be angry," or "my anger has made me weep." The anger and the tears are not cause and effect. They occur at the same moment as two aspects of the same thing. So it might be better to ask, in what way is anger an expression of misery? And this is a good time for a story. Once upon a time, there was a girl whose mother fussed over her all the time. The mother acted as if she was concerned about the child's welfare, but in reality, she was asserting her control over the girl. The girl, of course, understood at some level that there was no love going on here, and this produced a deep sorrow. She probably found various ways of suppressing the sorrow as she grew up so she could function with other people. She probably even forgot that her mother was so cruel. Years later, she's married, and let's say she's in the maternity ward about to give birth, and the nurses keep fussing over her, trying to make sure she is comfortable, also perhaps carrying out the necessary health and safety checks to fulfill the bureaucratic obligations of their job. They're going through the motions of caring for her, but in fact, they don't care about her, just about following the regulations. The woman goes into a rage of anger at these people fussing about her. But is she really angry at them? No, alas, she is, like Filippo, un che piango, one who weeps, as the pain from her childhood is stirred by the associations of fussiness and maternity. If she could look over the boat she is traveling in and see the reflection of herself in this swampy mirror of the unconscious, she would discover what her unconscious knew all the time, that it was the grief from her mother's mistreatment of her that was finally coming to the surface at this time as angry rage. I now recognize that I experience this link between anger and grief much more often than I would have thought. The other day I was trying to explain to a friend an idea that is very important to me, but she kept misunderstanding what I was saying. I'm a polite guy, and I smiled, and when I saw we were not going to get anywhere, I let it rest. But later I found myself, mi ritrovai, as Canto 1 put it, becoming angry at this friend who didn't understand me. In my anger I wanted to say something back that would hurt her, but then I felt a deep grief at not being understood, a sorrow at being unable to share this important idea. And then I felt anger again, and then grief, back and forth like some sort of neon sign blinking between two images. Anger, blink, weeping, blink, anger, blink, weeping. These shifts occurred within me much more subtly than that neon sign, of course. It took stillness and attention to notice them. But there they were, just as Dante had illustrated. I got every reason on earth to be mad, 'cause I just lost the only girl I had. If I could get my way, I'd get myself locked up today, but I can't, so I cry instead. I got a chip on my shoulder that's bigger than my feet. I can't talk to people that I meet.
loving man can do. Until then, I'll cry and say, I got every reason on earth to be mad. Cause I just lost the only girl I had. If I could get my way, I'd get myself locked up today. But I can't, so I'll cry instead. Don't wanna cry when there's people there. I get shy when they start to stare. I'm gonna hide myself away, hey, but I'll come back again someday. And when I do, you better hide all the girls. Cause I'm gonna break their hearts all around the world. Yes, I'm gonna break them in two and show you what your loving man can do. But till then, I'll cry instead.
There was the Beatles, I'll Cry Instead. John Lennon saw the point, bringing together anger and weeping, Un Che Piango. He says he's got every reason on earth to be mad, but rather than lash out in anger, I'll cry instead. If I could see you now, I'd try to make you sad somehow, but I can't, so I'll cry instead. He threatens to break all the girls' hearts, rather like the way these angry souls in the marsh are breaking each other into pieces. But until he does, he'll cry instead. A twisted cry for help from this sensitive soul who saw or felt the connection between anger and weeping. Back to Dante, who replies to Filippo Argenti, in weeping and in sorrow remain, cursed soul, for I have seen through all that filth. I know you. And that's the way to dismiss the anger. As soon as we recognize it, through all its disguises, we don't play around, but just get rid of it and move on. But alas, it's not quite that easy. The anger is still attached to us, as we see when Filippo now tries to climb on board the boat. Only now does Virgil come to Dante's aid. Virgil, standing for our human reason, our ability to perceive what's going on and assess it. And it's Virgil who effectively sends Filippo back to the swamp, freeing Dante. It's as though once we're brave enough to face our anger, then our intellect can show us the reasons why this passion is not worthy or appropriate for us. And to illustrate this further, let's have a wee fable by Robert Louis Stevenson called The Devil and the Innkeeper. Once upon a time, the devil stayed at an inn where no one knew him, for they were people whose education had been neglected. He was bent on mischief, and for a time kept everybody by the ears. But at last the innkeeper set a watch upon the devil and took him in the fact. The innkeeper got a rope's end. "Now I'm going to thrash you," said the innkeeper. "You have no right to be angry with me," said the devil. "I'm only the devil, and it is my nature to do wrong." "Is that so?" asked the innkeeper. "Fact, I assure you," said the devil. "You really cannot help doing ill," asked the innkeeper. "Not in the smallest," said the devil. "It would be useless cruelty to thrash a thing like me." "It would indeed," said the innkeeper, and he made a noose and hanged the devil. "There," said the innkeeper. So following Stevenson's Devil and the Innkeeper came the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. Pleased to meet you. Hope you caught my name. And as soon as you do catch it, and know the nature of his game, then, like Dante, you turn away from it and move on. There, said the innkeeper. We're just about at the end of this episode, but there's a little coda. After Virgil kicks Filippo away from the boat, sending him back to the other angry souls, he turns to Dante and kisses him, praising him for his alma steniosa, his indignant soul. Whatever sinful anger Dante had had has now been purified and transformed into a righteous anger, an anger whose energy gives us the power to set things right, in particular, to dismiss the harmful kinds of anger when we see them. This is perhaps Dante's first redeemed action in the poem, and as a consequence, Virgil turns to him and, with his arms around Dante's neck, kisses him. Blessed is she that bore you in her womb, rephrasing Elizabeth's words to Mary, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. In essence, Virgil is now identifying Dante with Jesus, who also, at appropriate moments, could lash out in righteous anger. And Virgil incidentally explains why Filippo Argenti was so angry. He was one of those arrogant people on earth who felt they were above everyone else and did nothing for anyone else. Their arrogance led them to expect that when they died, of course everyone would be praising them for their greatness on earth. But in fact, not one good deed adorned their memory. This is what both saddens Filippo and enrages him. And presumably at some level he understood this even when alive. And to close this episode, Dante the poet, always ready to take the most outrageous paths, has Dante the pilgrim express what at first seems a shocking desire. He turns to Virgil and says, I would like to see Filippo Argenti pushed deep down into this soup. It sounds like he's being vindictive, but what he is also doing is confirming his resolve to see this anger, his anger, remember, thoroughly destroyed. And before long, Dante sees this happen. Remember that this marsh is full of angry souls lashing out violently against each other and against themselves, and that's what happens as soon as Filippo falls back into the water. Everyone shouts, "Get Filippo Argenti!" and they start tearing him apart, and he himself joins them like Erisichthon, gnawing at himself with his own teeth. Anger is ultimately self-destructive. And they move on. There's no more to say here. But Canto 8 is only half finished. We've taken a long time to discuss this episode, and we'll have to return to Canto 8 next time and see what Dante and Virgil encounter when they cross the Stygian marsh and come to the first real obstruction to their progress. And so, good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, sharing with you this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105. We meet some bad monsters next time, so tune in then and see. And to close out the show, let's bring together weeping and anger, or tears and rage, with one of the best songs to come out of the basement tapes. These tears are really grief-filled, fueled by the ingratitude the father feels towards his child's rejection. Why am I always the one who must be the thief? Come to me now, we're so alone, and life is brief. There's a kind of rage at the grief. You listen and attend, and see how it works out. Here's the band with Tears of Rage.